Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and I am speaking today with Josh Hanford from the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, which, if you've never heard of them, they are a nonprofit and focused on strengthening and training and advocating for Vermont's local government statewide. It's a really dynamic organization. I recommend everyone check it out. Josh is here with us today. We're going to talk about some of the things that are moving through the legislature now and how they might impact your local government. Josh, as I understand it, you've only been with VLCT for about 6 months. What's that been like so far, and where were you beforehand?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. My role with the League of Cities and Towns, I'm the director of the Intergovernmental Relations, and I joined them in October. Before that, I was the Housing and Community Development Commissioner for the state of Vermont for about 5 years. And previous to that, I worked in state government in community development and housing for nearly 20 years. And so it's a little bit different perspective. I've always worked with local government and municipalities. I mean, there where stuff gets done, frankly, where policy gets implemented, where sort of the actions come into play. But it's certainly different being on this side and, you know, representing our members' interests and trying to understand, you know, what will make their job of local governing better and what will make their job harder, and trying to inform them of what's going on in the state house this year has been a tall task coming into it so recently, for sure.
Well, thanks for being with us today. And I should just note for listeners, we're pre-recording this on the 16th, which is a Tuesday. It will air, of course, on a Friday. And so given that the legislature's in session, a lot can happen between a Tuesday and a Friday. So just keep that in the back of your mind as you're listening, in case you're like, wait a minute, I read the headlines this morning and that's not what they said. Things have changed. Your colleague, Josh, Ted Brady, has been on the show a few times. And one of the things we talk about a lot is this tension in Vermont between local control and the fact that we're Dillon's rural state, and how much power actually rests with the state. And that's why when Ted and I happened to be talking last week, he mentioned this study bill on regional governance. And that just caught my attention because of the fact that we have this tension between local and state, and yet we don't really have a lot in between. Like other states might have a county government or another layer of government between state and local. So I'm curious, I'd love to hear more about this study bill and what it hopes to do.
Yeah, Ted Brady is the executive director of Vermont League of Cities and Towns. And Ted and I have worked together off and on for both of our careers, Senator Leahy's office where he was, and USDA Rural Development, Agency of Commerce and Community Development. And Ted has tremendous experience at all levels of government, really, you know, federal, state, local. And yeah, we're pretty unique. I believe there's only a couple other states like us in the whole country that have a Dillon's rural state, where we have local, you know, municipalities and no real county or regional government in between the state and local government. And, you know, a lot of our traditions and the way we've sort of developed, you know, go back hundreds of years, and sort of communities did what they needed to do and the legislature authorized their powers. That's what a Dillon rural state, how it's structured, is the municipalities receive their authority granted by the state legislature. So it does create some tension sometimes. We like to talk about our local control and we pride ourselves in it. But the reality is local control is only granted by the state legislature, and it creates some tension sometimes. This idea of a need for more regional government or county government has been around for a while. Sort of people have identified the regional planning commissions, for example, you know, down in your region, Windham Regional Commission, you know, provides a great service and technical assistance to communities and fills in a lot of those roles, but they're actually not a governance sort of structure for the region or the county. Of course, we have, you know, county courthouses and county sheriffs, but that role is very limited in our structure. And so what's interesting is a lot of this idea for this bill, and it's Senate Bill S-159, it's a county and regional governance study. really came out of some lessons learned from the flooding that we had this past summer, you know, July and August. And I remember being around in Irene, working in state government, a lot of recovery funding. I was in a community that was heavily impacted in Rochester and worked in that world. And a lot of the federal assistance and FEMA world and programs that come and provide assistance to states typically has a county sort of aspect to it. And so we're constantly trying to square peg, round hole idea, saying, oh, well, we don't have county government, you know, provide this money this way, or we need an exception, or we need a waiver, even with the ARPA money. And
That's right.
Yeah, that Senator Leahy was able to get a waiver for us because some of it was destined to county governments. And we said, we really don't have that structure. You need to give a waiver for Vermont so we can allocate that portion to local government. And so this has been brought up a number of times, and this bill was introduced, and the administration and, you know, governor's office said, hey, we're interested in studying this. We've had challenges with FEMA, with the Treasury, with the ARPA and the CRF money, trying to find a way to get our share absence of the county government structure that the federal government relies on across the country. So that sort of was the impetus for it. But the league has signed on and said we're supporters of this study. You know, we were named as well as a number of other folks on this study committee should this bill pass. You know, you'd think that we might be threatened by this, but we know there's a reality that different sized communities have a different ability to respond to the needs of their citizens. And really, the fundamental question that we're asking ourselves and our members are asking are, have we assigned the right level and role of government to the right size of government, to the right role? So, for example, should a town in Vermont of 500 people, which there's a lot of them, should they have the responsibility to provide a police department, a fire, an emergency response? Maybe that's not the right level of government to be responsible for those services. Maybe it should be slightly higher up. Certainly a town of that size needs to take care of its roads and, you know, collect its property taxes, but there's some big challenges out there. You name it, from, you know, opioid homelessness. Is every individual municipal government sort of responsible for all of those responsibilities, or is there a better level of government slightly above that can serve our citizens collectively better? And that's what we hope this study is going to talk about, some other models in other states. And I specifically said county and regional, because maybe the county structure isn't right. Maybe there's another model that could be, you know, more regional focused. Even our counties in Vermont are small comparative to many states, especially out west in population and in area. And so we don't want to go in with any preconceived sort of solutions. We really want to learn from each other, from experts from outside, and consider this in a thoughtful way, come back to the legislature. There's some money in there to have some outside professionals and consultants assist. So it's not, you know, self-interest from those that are appointed on the committee, and really see what it says. I mean, I think everyone has the same interest here. We want to make sure the government works for everyone, and it works for everyone, regardless of where they live, what size community they live in. And I think right now in Vermont, there's a lot of people saying that might not be happening. You know, is equity and all the things that government could provide, should provide, happening everywhere? And, you know, and I don't know that that's the case. And so this study might help us get there.
This resonates with me, Josh, as someone who lives in a small town that's, you know, 45 minutes from anything, if you're lucky. And one conversation, I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but obviously it's still trickling through my mind. After town meeting ended in Whitingham, the select board said, hey, folks, if anyone who can stick around, we want to just have a conversation about law enforcement in Whitingham. Because Whitingham's small enough that to have its own police department, I don't know that that's practical. So what they've been doing is they've been partnering with Wilmington for so many hours. I think it's a month. But of course, you know, Wilmington has its own priorities. And if there's a 3-car pile up on 100, they're not coming to do traffic tickets in Whitingham. It's just, right, it doesn't work. However, as someone who has had some experiences where she probably should have called the police, I didn't. I never bothered, because if they show up in 2 hours, you're lucky. And by then, the person who's broken into your house is gone, or if you're in a car accident. I hate our rules around not leaving the scene of an accident, only because if you're in a one car accident on the back roads of Whitingham and you have to wait for the police to show up and it's the middle of winter and you broke your leg, it so doesn't work. But it's had me thinking about it because I don't really care if someone's handing out traffic tickets, but I do want, if there's a genuine emergency, I want someone there to help. And that idea of scale and distance and who's getting served and who's not, I think really shows up in some of our law enforcement issues. But it also brings to mind for me, and you touched on it a little bit, I feel sometimes our local government, I'm looking for the right word because I don't think this is necessarily bad. I just think it's a reality, is really uneven in the sense that you might have a city like Burlington, where there's a mayor and a council and a police force and a fire department and a library, and like everything is staffed up. And you have this really broad, professionalized government. And they can do a lot with those type of resources and bring a lot of resources to their community, where you have another community where it's a 5-member select board and maybe, and probably a town clerk, a DPW, and a librarian are usually on staff. And that might be it. And that's a very different amount of resources that can be brought to the town or can address issues that might come to the town. So I find this regional governance interesting. Some of the things I just said, did that trigger anything for you or your member towns?
Yeah, I mean,
do they talk about this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm in Orange County, and so I'm in Randolph. I'm near Brookfield. And I like to say, Brookfield has to follow all the same rules as Burlington, but they don't have the resources, but they need to make sure they're meeting all those requirements. And it can be a struggle. I was just listening into a committee in the Senate talking about another bill we're following about municipal ethics. And there was a select board member testifying from Guildhall. It's a town of 200 people. They have 41 elected and appointed positions they need to fill in that town. It's filled by 26 people. So people have multiple, over 10% of the town is serving in what it takes to run that town in an elected or appointed fashion. That's a big ask. And you know how hard it is to get volunteers and to keep it going. You know, their issues were about more sort of unfunded mandates, or how are they going to comply? If you add one more thing or one more responsibility, they figure it out as it is. But a lot of people do multiple things, wear multiple hats, and it's hard for them to keep a separation, a conflict of interest, because you literally have, related members running a town when you have 10% of the population actually carrying out the duty. So I absolutely hear what you're saying. I think policing, public safety is a good example of, is it fair for communities that don't have enough resources to not have those services? Or should there be a different level of government that could provide them? And yes, there's intermunicipal agreements that can be hashed out between towns, but it always comes down to, a lot of those end up working fine. A lot of them end up failing after a while, because it comes down to who makes decisions and who pays. And one community is hosting at the will of another, and so it's not an equal power sharing structure. And so inevitably something happens where it doesn't work. And so some other way to do this is what we're hoping gets suggested in this bill, so that you're not depending upon this unequal, you said it, sharing structure where some community has all that another doesn't. And the one that doesn't have is asking and begging for that other community to serve them, but it's at their will. They're still the one in control making decisions. And I don't know that that's very equitable. So we'll see. I mean, it's just a start. I think, in your region, Windham Regional Commission, the executive director is, been mentioning this sort of where he came from in other parts of the country, that very unfamiliar territory to not have a county structure embedded in here somewhere to do some of the work, like think about river corridor management, think about flooding, right? So rivers don't stay within the boundaries of one town, but they impact everyone. How could one set of rules for one town and how the development and how you deal with flooding and make any sense, the town up and above and below, unless there was some sort of mutual interest in way of working through that? And that's a lot of what we talk about with our members. And that's one example of where our members this year said, you know what, local control might not be the best thing when it comes to flooding. We actually want the state to help us regulate our rivers in a way that we all benefit and we share the risks and we do the same flood control measures, as an example of a municipality sort of shifting and understanding that they only have so much capacity, they only have so much revenue, and it's getting stretched and harder to meet all those demands. And so we've got to be smart about where we quote unquote give up local control for the betterment of our neighbors and our surrounding communities.
Maybe the phrase needs to be, since we do also struggle in Vermont with the economies of scale sometimes, maybe the phrase could be shared control, because everybody's using the river and everyone's being impacted by the river. So how can we share this
control? I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. We'll see if it actually flies with a lot of our communities.
Right.
Well, I look forward to seeing how that develops, because I can see how this study and then the eventual implementation, if that's the right direction, could be a real cultural shift, and for some community members might actually be a hard or scary shift. So that'll be an interesting way to move to see what will happen. You said that's S159?
Yes.
Okay. So listeners, just so you know, in the show notes, I will link to the things we're talking about. And you can find the show notes over on our podcast page, which is the MontpelierHappyHour.captivate.fm, or wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Speaking of power and control and size of scale, can we circle back to the ethics bill, which I believe is H875?
That's right. Yep.
I think you brought up some interesting points with it. It also, though, for me, when I was looking at this ethics bill, I saw some of the problems you did. Again, you know, it's one thing for a fully professionalized town to take on some of these new regulations. It's another thing for, like you said, Guildhall is such a great example. And yet, you know, another thing I notice as someone who covers municipal government, going back to that sense of unevenness, I see it mostly in public meeting and public document rules, how they sort of get twisted and pushed and kind of adhered to sometimes. Is there are ways that we need to hold our towns accountable and our officials accountable. And like with the public meeting rules and the public document rules, there's a lot of ways that these officials aren't held accountable. Unless a newspaper has the ability to really bring someone to a court, sometimes that's what it takes to actually hold someone truly accountable, if they're truly playing some games with the right to know laws. So is there a better middle ground from VLCT's point of view about how do we make sure towns are ethically run without too much burden? But it, you know, where's the middle ground, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, no, great questions and great way you put that out there. And, you know, the league completely supports municipal ethics and wants to hold folks accountable, and the public demands it. I think, you know, there's a couple issues here that I think have sort of been lost. One, it was just 2019, the end of that session, that there was a law that required each municipality to adopt a code of ethics. So, and then the pandemic happened, and there's been quite a shift between, you know, hybrid meetings and remote meetings. And I don't know that that law has fully had a chance to even really, you know, be tested and to really serve its value. For one, you know, do we have the right data out there to understand what's going on? Second, you know, the sort of way we hold our elected officials accountable for certain is through the ballot box, right? Ethics, you can only put into law to a certain point. There's always going to be folks that maybe someone believes they're acting unethically. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Some of these are hard to prove. Do they rise to the level of where you're going to get a lawyer and proceed? Or is it sort of something that doesn't get that far? But we don't have an ability to recall folks. That's what we find interesting. The league has said, ultimately, the way you hold elected officials accountable is give the ability for the voters to recall someone. You know, yes, you can wait to the next election cycle, but if someone really is acting unethically, people are really concerned about their actions, but you can't hold them accountable because they're either technically not breaking the law, or there isn't enough, it's not serious enough to really, you know, warrant the attorney general going after them. Like, what do you do? Wait for the next election. We think that municipalities should have the right. This is back to that Dillon's rule. They don't have the right. Only a few have it through a charter, or you can petition. It's very difficult. But we think a strong way to hold folks accountable would be to allow recall elections. And sure, you want to make it a pretty high bar so that, you know, someone that has a grudge against one person on the select board, let's say, and is well-funded, doesn't create a campaign just to oust someone because they can. You want to have the number of people that need to, you know, petition, sign to support the recall in a community be a high bar. But we think that would go a long way to hold people accountable. The other, you know, just general concerns in this bill are there's an ask to have certain trainings required. We think training is a great way to help people understand open meeting law, public records requests, code of ethics, conflict of interest. But there is nowhere else in statute that requires an elected official to have mandated training. And so this would be a first. What happens if they refuse it? Are you going to unseat them? How is that going to happen? So it sets up this dynamic to create some unnecessary conflict, I think, when you're saying you must take this training, but there's no way to hold them accountable if they don't take the training. And so what happens then? Are they automatically accused of being unethical because they refuse to take the ethics training? So there's just some ways that this is being carried out that we think are going to have some, we don't want to have ethics weaponized, you know, at the local level. And so that's really some of the fear. And the number of people like that town of Guildhall, all those elected officials, that's a lot of training that's yet to be designed, yet to be approved. You know, maybe we can narrow it down to, you know, the legislative bodies, you know, the chair, something. And the league wants to work on this and find some compromise that makes sense, because training is valuable. It is important to know this, that the public needs the trust of their elected and appointed officials and employees. But we just want to be careful that we're not sort of opening Pandora's box here in a way that may be counter to the goals. So this bill, you know, is in the Senate Government Operations right now. There's Secretary of State's office, the Ethics Commission, and the League are trying to work on some compromises around some areas. But we've heard some strong testimony from some municipalities that are very concerned and opposed to what this will do, what this will set up in their community. And yet there are folks, members of the public, former members of boards that believe there's, you know, some ethical issues going on in municipalities. So folks are right on both sides of this, and we have to find the right balance here. And that's what a lot of this is about. You know, what we talked about earlier, balancing what needs to be done with the capacity of the community to respond and not break the system. And so, you know, I'm sure if your viewers or listeners, you know, you could see a variety of opinions and testimony on this bill. And an interesting piece is school boards are municipalities in the state of Vermont, but they were purposely excluded from this bill for some reason we can't understand, when in reality, they have much more budgetary, you know, there's much larger dollars to be considered in many cases. And so there's folks raising that issue. Why weren't school districts and those school board members included in this, and why have a different standard of whistleblower protection and civil action of state employees versus municipal employees? There's some concerns of sort of retaliation, or if someone, you know, sort of brings lawsuits towards municipal officials, it could tie up things. And we just need to get it right, because everyone wants to trust their elected and appointed officials, folks that they have to count on to act appropriately and ethically. And I think everyone can agree we all want that. But, you know, let's make sure we're doing this right and not breaking anything or having unintended consequences is really where we're at with this bill.
You know, I think my curiosity question around this bill, but probably around municipal government in general in Vermont, is The great thing about running for local elected office is anyone can do it. Technically, not everyone feels welcome. Not everyone has the finances, but technically everyone can do it. The flip side to that means everyone comes to the positions with different skill sets. And some people may have had experience, you know, now they're on the select board, but before they were on the school board, and before that they were a library trustees, and it's taught them some leadership skills throughout the years, but someone might come cold to it. And I think, again, that's a kind of another thread of unevenness in some of our local governments. It's just people's skill sets are at different places. And what do you do when that skill set doesn't actually let someone rise to the level perhaps they need to be at
Yeah,
to govern
absolutely.
well?
It's complicated. I mean, in many cases, you're setting the rules and requirements for your neighbors. I mean, you know, think about someone that's on a DRB or a zoning board, you know, could be your neighbor that's proposing something and vice versa. And so, yeah, we all need to be held accountable for, you know, being treating people fairly and acting ethically. And, you know, at least everyone shares that goal. Like the actual process, the steps, the approach you take to get there, I think there's some disagreements of each branch of government holds itself accountable for their and responsible for ethics, if you will. The legislature has, you know, their own ethics panel and their own process. The federal government and municipalities at this point do as well. And so would we be changing that dynamic and saying, actually, nope, the state government is going to actually oversee municipal ethics and they don't hold themselves accountable anymore? That's more the philosophical, you know, concern that's sort of changing a pretty big dynamic. And I think we would agree, the league, that we want to provide more ethics training. We want to provide more certainty, like holding people accountable through recall elections. But do you shift a local government from holding its accountable to their own rules and put that power somewhere else? I think is the philosophical sort of a disagreement on the approach that's being proposed at this point. Not that people should be held accountable. There should be a way to do it. People should have, you know, a voice. That's sort of where we are. But this bill it sort of came out of the House Government Operations Committee fairly late in the session. It didn't have a bill number. That's why it's such a high bill number, 875. It really didn't emerge until a few weeks ago. And so I think it caught a lot of municipalities a little off guard because there wasn't a bill number to refer to earlier. You know, maybe they weren't as informed. And, you know, I think some felt a little accused of being, what, they think every small community has this unethical behavior going on. Where did this come from? And so there's been some emotion attached to it for sure. And, you know, I'm hopeful we'll come out in the right place. The legislature does have a deliberate process. They hear a lot of different sides and, you know, there's a lot of compromise made. So I'm hopeful this will end up in the right place for everyone.
Thank you, Josh. So listeners and viewers of the Montpelier Happy Hour, Josh and I are going to take a break so we can hear from some of our underwriters here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. If you're just joining us, I'm the host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and I am speaking with Josh Hanford from Vermont League of Cities and Towns. He's the Director of Intergovernmental Relations, and we've just been joined by the Executive Director of VLCT, Ted Brady. Very glad to have you here, Ted. Thank you for joining
great.
Us.
Yeah, great to be with you. Thanks for having both of us here.
So for both of you, before we dive into the conversation, I have to do a couple housekeeping things. First, hey, BCTV, thank you for sharing the video version of our podcast with other pig stations across Vermont. And two, the views and opinions of Everyone at the Montpelier Happy Hour are those of the host and the guest, and nobody else, not the platform, not the radio station, not their house plants, not their other colleagues, just us. So if you ever want to complain about that, you can always send me an email at themontpelierhappyhour@gmail.com. There you go. So Ted, just before you joined us, we had talked about regional governance and the ethics bill, 875. And we were looking to segue to tax sales, which is a bill, H629. I would love to start with you some of the thoughts on this bill. Oh, and I'll step back. Sorry, Ted. Emily Kornheiser, who's normally on the show, but is taking a break, Representative Kornheiser, she is actually one of the folks who was working with this bill because of, for her, there were a lot of different ways that towns were doing tax sales. And I think part of the goal was to have one method for if someone's not paying their taxes, when can the town auction off their house? Is that a fair summary of that bill?
Yeah, I think that's a fair motivation for kind of why we're even having this conversation. And, you know, for those that don't know, towns in Vermont have the ability, when you don't pay your taxes, to take your home to tax sale. And that means that all the other liens, everything else that you might have on your home, right, is at risk, because if you don't pay your taxes, the town can actually go and auction off your house. And then you have a year to redeem, meaning you could pay your taxes in that year. And if you don't pay your taxes, whoever showed up at the auction to buy the house gets to take possession of the home. It's a pretty common technique across the entire country. It's not unique to Vermont. Mm-hmm. We wrote the book on tax sales, the Delinquent Tax Collector Handbook. So every town has a delinquent tax collector. It's a position in statute. Oftentimes it's the treasurer, but it defaults to the town manager in many towns that have town managers. In a place like Brattleboro, you know, you have somebody who's designated to do tax collection and stuff. And it absolutely, this book about how to do tax sales is the best practices of doing tax sales. The law, the state law, codifies the bare minimum you have to do. Our delinquent tax collector handbook then takes all the case law on this, takes the best practices that make this a fair and democratic process. We bundled it into this document. The bill that originally, 629's original purpose, far exceeded what we just talked about, making a consistent tax sale process, and really questioned whether the tax sale process is appropriate, and said, perhaps people who don't pay their taxes should not face the law, the possibility of losing their home. And I think that was in the equity in their home. That was really where, on the House side, the bill started at. And now, today, we're at a much different position. The bill largely does codify the existing best practices in tax sale law. The bill codifies case law that is not in statute and sets that standard.
Mm-hmm. Could one of you just give us some examples of best practices around something like a tax sale?
Sure, I can drop a couple, and then maybe Josh can chime in with a couple. A good example of a best practice in a tax sale is working with a delinquent taxpayer to try to get them to pay their taxes before you bring them to tax sale. And the way you could do that is by offering them tax abatement. So say, hey, if you know, if something's happened in your life, you know, you had a horrible injury, you have a natural disaster affecting your home, and you can't pay your taxes, you can file for tax abatement. A second option is to allow some sort of a repayment plan. And so that if you're, you know, you owe $2,000 in taxes and you can't come up with that $2,000, for the tax collector to say, hey, why don't we start a repayment plan where you're giving me $200 a month, and we're going to make sure you pay this year's taxes on time so you don't become delinquent that time. Mm-hmm. And so there's those types of processes. Josh, were there any other that you could think of?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things this bill does is it sort of puts into best practice the time that you're allowed to, before you take it to tax sale.
Right.
The law before allowed you, as soon as you were delinquent, you could go to tax sale. But that really wasn't the practice. It wasn't the advice of the league. It was, you know, more common to see a year go by. And that's what this bill does now. The current language puts into practice a year before it goes to tax sale, and then there's another year to redeem it. And so that provides more time for the delinquent taxpayer to find a way to come up with resources to, you know, pay their back taxes. It also sort of codifies best practices on the time frame for notices. There's a number of notices that go out. in the paper, first class mailing, a certified mail. And so it really brings all that within it with the goal of making sure the taxpayer knows that they're behind in their taxes. And if they don't rectify it, it could go to tax sale. And I think one of the things to bring up is, where this bill started of maybe saying tax sale shouldn't happen. I don't think anyone likes tax sales as far as the tax collector, the towns, the owner involved, but property taxes is our largest source of tax income. And municipalities are told they have to collect property taxes. Much of that, 70-80%, goes to the state. So, this is fundamental to the way we pay our bills. And so as much as this is a challenge and had equity goals, there really is a fundamental need to have people compel them to pay their property taxes. Otherwise, a lot of the other things we try to do at local government, state government, aren't really possible if we don't have a way to compel people to pay the property taxes.
Thank you for sharing that, Josh, because one thing I was just mulling over as Ted was talking is, I can see that philosophical question of should people lose their homes if they can't pay their taxes, especially in a state that's having a housing crisis. Yes, another family might be able to buy that home, but you've still got someone without a home. And so that larger philosophical question, though, about how do we work with our community members if they can't pay their taxes? Like, that feels a little bit like a gap too, even though you're right. I mean, we need to pay for our schools and our roads too. What's the balance there, or what's the conversation happening there?
Well, I think one of the real challenges to Vermont's property tax law is the program, the property tax credit program that we have, the income sensitized property tax credit, right? There's the solution to, if you don't want people who are low income to pay taxes, then you can create a program that says you don't need to pay your taxes. And that's what the legislature, I hope, would really focus on. If you want a low income person to stay in their home, you can make a law that says you don't need to pay taxes, or we're going to, credit your taxes down to a certain level. We actually already have that. There are some taxpayers that pay almost no property tax because of the circuit rider provision and a few other weird property tax issues based on their income sensitivity. What we heard in the legislature and we've seen out there in practice is there are some Vermonters who, even though they qualify for income sensitized property taxes, aren't taking advantage of it. Because they don't file their taxes. And that's something that the tax sale process doesn't need to be changed for. We need to create systems that ensure that the taxpayers understand the existing programs that are out there. I think that's the big solution. And then, the other real difficult thing of Vermont's housing crisis is how many people are overhoused. And that's really complicated, right? When you get to property rights and all these fun things. But I think that this whole conversation manifests itself because we have single people, couples living in big old houses on big pieces of land, and they can't afford the tax burden of that situation. And that's a really complicated policy, but I don't think the tax sale policy is the problem there. I think that's a bigger housing policy issue that I don't know how to crack.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. And, we brought this up in context of this bill and in testimony, what Ted was just after. We know we have this income sensitivity solution, but it's not used by everyone. It's hard for the tax department to force people to do it. Certainly can't be, municipality can't sort of credit folks for a property tax rebate that they didn't receive. But we had a federal program that was from ARPA funds that was available for about 2 or 3 years that help people pay their mortgage and property taxes if they were low income, if they were struggling because of impacts of COVID. And that fund proved that, about half of the folks that applied and qualified were seeking assistance on property taxes. That fund is now gone. The goal was really to hold people harmless that really can't afford their property taxes, even though they own a home, land. We need to come up with some way to use some source of funding to pay the difference, because the municipality has to collect the taxes, the education fund needs its taxes, and that's a really complicated solution. But I also want to mention that there's other types of property tax sales. There's vacant land, There's vacant and abandoned property, there's commercial. And I think that when we talk to a lot of delinquent tax collectors and municipalities, that's a lot of the properties that they go that they have to put up for tax sale. Is land is vacant and abandoned. They don't know who the owner is. It's been multiple years. And so we really have to balance out the needs here and the impacts on lower income individuals.
Thank you. So just to summarize, what this bill is doing now in H-629 at this stage of the legislative process is it has basically codified some of the best practices and a timeline that triggers a tax sale. So first the town has to do this, and then this, and this, and then it can take it to tax sale. So it sounds like it's laying out more of a straightforward process.
It does put into law what many towns are already doing that are the best practices. I also want to be clear, there are some provisions of the bill as it's drafted now that will make it harder to do tax sales. It will expand the time that towns have to wait for, and it creates some complications in timelines. Like if you know, you're a town that collects your taxes three times a year, taxes really aren't late until the end of the year. Then the clock starts there, even though the person hasn't paid their taxes on time for 6 months. Like there's all these weird little anomalies that I think the VLCT is trying to be supportive, because we think most of the stuff in this bill is what towns are doing. But we do think there are some towns that are going to get tripped up. We're going to probably be back here next year saying, we tried to do this, but we need to tweak this because the town of X is really having trouble operationalizing this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Let's talk about the ever popular, I bet you can even guess what I'm going to say, Act 250. I know there's a few bills kind of making their way through the State House right now around Act 250. I think the most popular one is the one that's made it the furthest, and I'm forgetting its number, but it sets up some tiers in the state that portions of the state will be tier one, tier two, tier three, and that will govern how Act 250 kind of kicks in based on what tier you happen to be living in. What is VLCT's opinion on where Act 250 is going? I mean, everybody else has an opinion on Act 250. I would love to hear yours.
How about it, Ted?
I think our primary goal here is to address the number one concern of our members. This is like the third year in a row we've done a membership survey that says the number one thing they're concerned about is access to affordable housing and access to housing. So we come to this conversation saying we need more housing, period. Act 250 in many places of the state adds no value where there are robust municipal planning policies in place. And so our number one policy concern is to say, let's give those municipalities that have robust planning and zoning in place that in historic settlement patterns, let's give them the ability to manage their land use and facilitate more housing growth and not have Act 250 as a duplicative process over that. So we're trying to get this tier 1A concept, which in tier 1A areas, which are your most, you know, densely settled areas across the state of Vermont, historic settlement patterns where we want development, we don't think Act 250 should apply there. And that seems to be the consensus in the legislature this year. Where there isn't consensus, and where the league actually understands that our members are a little divided on this also, so we haven't been real neck deep in it, knee deep in it, is
depends, you know, how much there is to be deep in.
Yes.
Much.
What do you do with the places that are not tier 1A?
Right.
You know, what do you do for 90% of the state, 95% of the state? What's the level of protection you want to create beyond Act 250? Because that's the negotiation, right? If we're going to take Act 250 jurisdiction away here, most of the state's still going to have the same Act 250 jurisdiction. And a lot of the state is now going to have a new level of protection that it didn't have before this. And that's a little more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'll just add, as we talked about earlier, you know, being involved in housing for a while, I think that, you know, so far, the way we've dealt with Act 250 and giving some exemptions to allow housing is with our designation programs. And, you know, great that communities went through a process and have a designation. It provides benefits, but they really weren't designed to serve all of our housing needs in the state. And take Brattleboro, for example. Only a teeny part of downtown Brattleboro is a designated downtown. And that's where we've said, okay, you can get a pass on Act 250 up to a certain number of houses and great, but we know that's only 0.3% of the whole state. And so, and many of these areas are in floodplains or in places that really, you know, maybe aren't the smartest place to grow more. And so how do we think to the future a little bit and look at, you know, climate-informed policies around housing and where they should be, where it should be built, where's our future lie? And it might not be the exact same places that everyone in the state house is saying, okay, we agree these are the okay places. Every community across the state maybe wants to grow, maybe wants to have a chance, as we talked about a little bit earlier, to have their school open. And so are we cutting those areas off from their sort of future and their decisions? And that's, I think, the big concern that's hard to actually determine right now, if this bill and the tier process will result in that or not. There's a lot of sort of trust built into this process with future land use mapping and coordination with the regional planning commissions and municipalities and the Act 250 board. And so it just, there's a lot of attention on this bill, and it's really three bills merging into one: H-687, S-311, and S-308. And so it's a big body of work that's being undertaken right there, and a lot of attention on it, for sure.
I'll admit, I have some of the same questions about this tier system. On the one hand, I think it could really simplify a few things. You know what tier you're in, and then you kind of know how Act 250 is going to act. But I have the same question of what happens if you identify this really specific natural corridor on a river that needs to be protected, but that corridor goes through four different towns that are trying to put in wastewater and water and sewer infrastructure and grow their population. Like, what happens then? And like I think Josh said, are we predetermining towns' ability to develop and attract businesses or attract residents with this tier system? So that's still that's a question mark for me still too.
And I think the number one way to avoid that, you know, pitfall of this agreement is to make sure municipalities have a say in the mapping process. So that municipalities, you know, a map is a political document. I wish it was science, but it is a political document. We all know that from elementary school, right? Mm-hmm. The world is centered around North America on most of our maps for some weird reason.
Yes.
and so as long as municipalities have a real valued seat at the table in developing these maps and through rulemaking and such, I think there's a way to get to a happy place.
A middle ground.
Can we talk about some of the things that are in this conversation that are not Act 250, though?
I would love that. Yes, please.
So last year's housing bill really focused on municipal preemption and telling towns they can't do things the way they've done them all the time. We became the first state in the country, maybe the second state in the country, to require duplex by right in the country, right? That's a big thing. Mm-hmm. Single family zoning is gone in Vermont.
Yeah,
it really already was because we already allowed ADUs, but this was even a step further. We also required anywhere where there's water and sewer to allow for up to 5 units per acre. Mm-hmm. So there goes, you know, large lots. This year, once again, there's a bunch of preemptions in the bill that Vermonters should know about. One of them is taking our upzoning from 5 units per acre and a place that has water and wastewater to 12 units per acre in a place that has water and wastewater. It's a big change. Might be appropriate in a lot of places in Vermont, and it might not in others. I think Stowe just gave an example. If they were to develop 12 unit per acre zoning across their sewer district, it would be 75,000 units of housing in Stowe, wow. Vermont. So, you know, it's appropriate in some places. It might not be appropriate in others. Within their own town, right? Maybe there's an area that you need to designate so many units. Another preemption this year that's on the table is preventing towns from being able to have a say in when a hotel is converted from a hotel into permanent housing, which is happening across the state. I think the reality is that hotels need different infrastructure than permanent housing. And then another preemption that's in there is a requirement that towns accept tandem parking as, you know, multiple parking spots. So if you're in an apartment building with four units and you have one driveway that's one car long, right now a town might say you need to have four spots, one unit per house, one spot per unit. This law says, well, you could put four cars in a straight line and they could play the, you know, the puzzle game all night long. These are preemptions that will have impacts on the quality of life of all Vermonters. And it's really important to remember why we have zoning. Zoning is a really complicated process that tries to balance individual property rights with the rights of the community.
Right.
And I think most of us agree that having the decision makers as close as possible to the voter is important. And that's why we have local zoning. Mm-hmm. So there's some things in here that also make us nervous. We think this year's focus should be on Act 250. We focused on municipal zoning last year. Let's focus on the most discriminatory zoning law we have in the state, which is Act 250. And so we hope that this year we can create, how about this, an inclusionary statewide zoning law through Act 250.
I would just add that, you know, the piece that seems a little ironic to me is if you take what Ted just said about the additional preemption of local zoning in this bill, and then the discussion we had about the tier 1, 2, 3 and where they're going to allow Act 250 exemption, you have two different things going on. You have a municipality that has zoning for a certain area, and they said, oh, we're going to allow this high of apartments and this density and this much housing. But the state's going to say, no, you can't allow that. You have to, we're requiring you to you must have to allow this. The other parts of the town where they have zoned for more density, they've zoned for growth, they've zoned for water sewer expansion, the state's saying, we're not going to give you Act 250 exemption there. You have to meet this requirement that we're saying you're a tier 1A. And so it feels like, I'm hopeful that this bill finds a way to weave those, because working at odds is not going to sort of help the development of the housing we need. And furthermore, I think, you know, Ted's been a champion of this. Really what we need is we need revenue and resources at the municipal level to put in infrastructure to see this, to realize the housing goals. Like, you can demand all you want for this development, but if there isn't any resources to actually allow the density that we need to protect the environment, allows you to conserve some of those other parts, sensitive parts of the state, it's all for naught. And that really hasn't come through, unfortunately. And it's a big ask. Municipalities say they want housing, they say they want, but they need some help with the resources to bring in the infrastructure to welcome more residents.
And I think, you know, we only have probably like 4 minutes left, Ted, but I think one of the things you had suggested we talk about is municipal revenues. Is that something you think you could just give listeners a flavor of?
Oh, so easily. As every Vermonter knows, the only way most towns get any money is by taxing your property.
Yes.
And that's not because that's the only place towns think is an appropriate place to get money. It's because that's what the legislature says. That's it. Very few towns in Vermont have the local option tax authority. About 24 can also collect local option taxes. And we're sitting here at a time when the education fund is sucking every dollar out of the property tax it possibly can, mm-hmm. leaving a table scrap to run the fire department, the police department, the rec program, to pave your roads, to maintain your roads. And so every state that borders us has a statewide revenue sharing program where they share some of the sales tax, where they share some of the cannabis tax, or they share some of the gambling tax with municipalities, recognizing that this is a federal, state, local partnership to provide all these services for Vermonters. We don't have that here in Vermont. We're the only state in New England that doesn't have a program like that. So we think that we need to really look at other ways to fund municipal government. Let's look at the local option tax. That should be available to every Vermont community if they so choose to enact it. Let's look at revenue sharing. Let's look at every new tax we put in place and say, should the town get a share of this? Sports betting is a great example. Cannabis is the best example. Why in God's name do towns not get a share of the cannabis revenue? They are the ones that are shouldering the burden. It's their communities that are hosting these shops, their communities that are hosting these farms. There are communities that are dealing with the impacts of drug-related crime and drug prevention programs. The state can't do all that. We see it on the ground. So we're hopeful that there's actually a revenue study in a tax bill, the miscellaneous tax bill 529, I think, that would look at this and see if there's a way that we could create some new revenues for municipalities. Hopefully that will survive the end of the session. We got 4 weeks left to find out.
I know, we're at the gate, the tunnel, the light is in sight. Well, thank you. I didn't realize we didn't have a revenue sharing plan in Vermont. I just assumed some of the taxes around cannabis was going to the local towns too. So thank you. That's new for me. I did not know that.
Another perfect example is short-term rentals. You know, the communities are the ones that deal with the impacts, whether it's taking away, you know, permanent housing, whether there's the impacts of the visitors. There should be a way to share short-term rental revenue with the municipalities where they're hosted so they can mitigate those impacts and respond to the needs. And so, you know, that's something we're asking for as well. I will say that, you know, some very good news on this subject is there is some new language in the miscellaneous tax bill that is contemplating allowing municipalities to enact local option taxes by a vote, not having to go to the legislature every single municipality one at a time and get a charter. And so we're hopeful that moves forward. You know, it still only allows 1% on rooms and meals, 1% on sales, 1% on alcohol if you choose it. But it's a start. We think there needs to be a more equitable sharing model that takes in the needs of municipalities of all sizes, as we talked about earlier, Olga, of, you know, town you live in, like, boy, it'd be really nice if you know you could depend on a police officer when you needed it on a back road, but with the revenue that they have, it's not possible and you have to depend on someone else. So
I know all my neighbors. The nice thing about that is I know all my neighbors. I know who I can call. Well, on that note, we are out of time on the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro. But I want to thank you, Ted Brady, Executive Director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and Josh Hanford, the Director of Intergovernmental Relations, for joining me today. If people want to learn more about VLCT, where can they go?
Hope you'll go to vlct.org and you can get a lot of resources there, get our weekly advocacy updates, and learn about what we're tracking in the State House.
And as always, the Montpelier Happy Hour is on the radio every Friday at 2 and rebroadcast on Wednesday on BCTV and, of course, wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Have a great weekend, everyone. Take care.
Thank you.